Accession number 8736, rule number 12.
I think that at that time, this was when my battalion was at Tidworth and was part of Jack Collins' mobile force, or whatever it was called. And at that time, Bernie Fuller and Little Hart seemed to me to be preaching a doctrine that armor by itself could be decisive in a war, in a campaign. And they drew a parallel from the American Civil War, well, whatever his name was, I can't remember, the cavalry commander went round the back and the flanks of the Confederate forces and was scored a big success. And they thought, or they taught and they preached the gospel of tanks, armored formations, operating on their own, and getting round the flanks of the opposing army and cutting their communications. And even at that time, it did seem to me that that was a far-fetched conclusion. And that I doubted very much that if it was effective. I don't remember being very hit up about it, but I do remember thinking that was it really so that armor by itself, operating on its own, without infantry and artillery, could achieve that sort of thing? And that sort of thinking, I suppose, developed perhaps subconsciously in my mind until I went out. I was out in the Western Desert when it I came to a firm conclusion that that was not practicable or feasible or the right answer, and that the team really consisted of, had to be comprised of armor, artillery, infantry, and engineers. And that was the assault team, the fighting team. But then I think I would be wrong to say that I'd come to that conclusion at that time. That was my conclusion later on. And during my experience of the Crusader operations, which was the second major campaign in the Western Desert. And that was what I tried to apply finally when in the third campaign, the final campaign in the Western Desert, when I was in command of 7th Army Division. But I think it was a very gradual process, and I wouldn't like to claim, I would be dishonest if I tried to claim that I thought to that extent or in that final way at the time that you're referring to. When I was a staff officer and Southern Commander at Tidworth, and when I was a company commander in the mobile force, which was armor, which was commanded by a brigade, it was commanded by Jack Collins on the plain. In those days, of course, people were very critical about that armored force, and at one time we were described as no advance without security.
Caution.
Collins was a good commander, but the army was a bit obsessed, looking back on it, in my opinion at that time, by the importance of a really comprehensive and well-designed and well-planned fire plan in any offensive. I think we got over-obsessed with that and forgot or didn't realize the importance, which was brought out in the beginning of the Second World War, particularly by Rommel and the Blitzkrieg. And I mean, Rama wouldn't have been. This is another sort of object lesson that one learned, perhaps again, only to a subconscious way. That armor by itself was very vulnerable, and that it had to have infantry, artillery, and engineers with it. But this, I would hate anybody to think, or you to think, or the people who listen to these tapes to think that that was fully in my mind when I was with the armored force in Tinworth, or when I was the staff officer at Southern Command. It was a start, the beginning of a developing process of thought.
What happened to you after Salisbury? Where did you go then? What was your posting?
Well, I went, first of all, I went to Catterick as brigade major of an infantry brigade, 13th Brigade. And 13, while I'm on it to tell you, is my lucky number. The Somersetshire Infantry are the 13th Regiment of Foot. In Catterick, I was brigade major of the 13th Brigade. At the early part of the Second World War, I was chief of staff of the 13th Corps. And I finished the Second World War in command of the 13th Corps. And when I was in Cyprus, I was asked to present the new standards to the 13th Squadron of the Royal Air Force. So 13 has gone through my latter part of my life, anyway. Anyway, that's by the way. I went to Catterick as brigade major of the 13th Infantry Brigade. And I had my brigadier, was a chap called Brigadier David Foster, who was a dedicated soldier, but unfortunately for him, he had a very bad stomach. And he was also an ardent supporter of the Oxford Group and anti-blood sport, to my disadvantage. However, I persuaded him. He was mad keen on tactical exercises. I mean, he always wanted to be having what he called command exercises and signal exercises with the battalion commanders and their staff and the affiliated gunner regiment commander and so on. And so I persuaded him that if he let me use his chargers for hunting, he had two chargers and I had one, I would be able to produce, I'd get to know the country, and I would be able to produce the bones of a tactical exercise for him at the shortest possible notice. And he swallowed this, in spite of his anti-blood sports and Oxford Group sympathies. And so I did, but both horses were lame before the hunting season started. So anyway, I had my own horses. And my wife was 18 on hunting, so we had a marvelous time at Catterick. We made a lot of friends. Once you get to know them, they're extremely kind and hospitable, the people who live in that part of Yorkshire. But you've got to get to know them. And it was, you know, the garrison life was great fun. And we had a tiny little house, a little quarter, and a small boy, and a nanny and a cook. Oh, we managed all right. But it was hard going. But very enjoyable, very good fun. And my brigadier, as I say, was an Oxford groupist and mad keen on tactical exercises. And so, but he was a very, very dedicated soldier. And I learned a lot from him. I used to perhaps sometimes wickedly amuse myself by presenting him with a administrative problem about a court-martial or a court of inquiry and watching him wrestling with his soul while he's putting the pros and cons to him and so on. But that perhaps was wrong. But he tried to convert me to buckmanship, or whatever it's called. But I was still I wasn't swallowing it at all. But then he told me once, told my wife that she had hidden fires, but that didn't fire her to go much to myself. No, he was a very good. I remember very well one occasion, a tactical exercise in the Yorkshire Roads, and the final situation was, you've been fighting hard. And the enemy was in retreat, and you found yourself in a position where you saw below you the enemy columns withdrawing. So what did you, how did you feel? That was the question. And it was very cold, and the group of commanding officers and so on were obviously longing to get back to the tea and the whiskey. And so he started off and he said, well, now, how do you feel in this situation? With his stutter. And he got various answers. What do you do? How do you feel? What do you do? Well, I didn't feel anything, anyway, except feeling rather cold. But they said, oh, well, you do a personal reconnaissance you get an O group, you get your battalion commanders up, and so you're supposed to be in command of a brigade, eh? Or your company commanders or whatever. Anyway, they were all rather, you know, rudimentary and perfunctory answers. And the old man got terribly worked up and excited. He said, no, no, no. How do you feel? Don't you feel that you now at long last have got behind the enemy and you can cut off his retreat? And there was no corresponding inspiration of the group at all. But that's the sort of chap he was. He was brilliant, but he never got any further. He was handicapped because you see, people used to take advantage of his Oxford groupism, and they would go to his meeting in order to curry favour and get promotion. And this was a very, very bad factor. And this is why I think it's always a mistake for a commander to have any strong and visible, active, obvious personal opinion to do politics, if you like. In its widest sense, I don't mean party political politics, but sort of the effect of, now you take for example a chap like Arthur Smith, who was chief of staff to Archie Wavell. He was equally devout Christian, but he never tried to suss it down anybody's throat, and he never made use of it. I mean, he never expected any of his subordinates or staff to follow him in that respect. Well, that was the right attitude. But David Forster, some people rather cashed in on this aspect of his interests and his devotion. And that I think, it's a very bad thing for any commander to have any outstanding and partisan interest of that kind. I call it partisan, but that's not the right word. I learned from him. But he was a marvellous chap.
When did you go to the Tsar? I understand you were in the
Tsar. While I was up there, while I was brigade major of that brigade, the arrangement, the plan, the Treaty of Versailles provided that after a certain period, after the war, there should be a plebiscite in the Tsar to decide whether the Tsar territory went to Germany or France. And there was to be a plebiscite. And of course it is terribly important because it's a coal-producing and an iron-producing area, a very, very important industrial centre, Saarbrücken and the surrounding country. Very important industrially and commercially. And so there was to be a plebiscite. And this was fixed, where it had been by the Treaty of Versailles. It was fixed to take place, I think it was 1935. And it was decided to set up an international force to go and support the local authorities. It was run by, I suppose, the League of Nations authority. At least the chap who was High Commissioner, whatever they called it, with a staff, an international staff, who administered the territory while it was in limbo. And this plebiscite was to be held, and it was decided to send an international force there to be at the disposal of the commissioner, or whatever he was called, to maintain law and order and keep the balance during the conduct of this plebiscite. And the international force was consisted of a British contingent, a Dutch contingent, an Italian contingent, and a Swedish contingent. And the brigade that I was brigade major of was selected to provide the British contingent of headquarters, a brigade headquarters, and two infantry battalions. Essex, was it, or the Lancashire Fusiliers? Essex and the South Lancs. And then we went out to, and we were our area, and there was a chap called John Brind, who was a gunner in charge of the whole international force. And he had the chief of staff, a chap called Jack Swain, who was in my regiment, who I knew very well. And John Brind I knew because he had been commander in chief in India, Pune, when I was commanding a battalion there. So I knew the top structure very well. And a chap called John Priestman was in command of the brigade, who was a very good man. And I was a brigade major, a staff captain, who was a linguist. I can't remember, it's Barclay, I think his name was. And we went out, and we were given Saarbrücken as our area, Saarbrücken and the immediately surrounding area. And our job was to be ready to support the police in case of any outbreaks of disorder, and also to help in the conduct of the plebiscite. That was developed in a way which we didn't expect when we went there. Well, when we arrived at Saarbrücken, we weren't made very welcome. The German element of the population were not actively hostile, but what you might call silently hostile. And if I may tell you one illustrative incident, within about a week or 10 days after we arrived, I had a small posse of military police, about a dozen of them, who were mounted on motorcycles, all of whom spoke German and had served in the Rhineland after the First World War. And so they were well acquainted with the Germans. And I used to always have two of them standing by to go out and to report and discover what was happening in any particular emergency. And one night, we got a report that there was a riot going on in a cafe in Saarbrücken, and the British troops were involved. So I sent two of these chaps out to find out what had happened. And the story, and it's quite a true story, was that a group of British soldiers, about half a dozen of them, I suppose, were having supper in a cafe. And they were enjoying themselves. They were laughing and joking and that sort of thing. And there were a lot of Germans round about. And some German from one of the neighboring tables sent over a message, and which was written, "Trouble with you British is you think you own the world." And this was passed round, and they all laughed and joked about it. And then one wag wrote on the bottom, "We do," and sent it back. The table, you see. Well, this started a bit of a riot. But by the time my two policemen got there, it all quietened down and everything was calm and normal. It all wound up itself all right. So, but that was the atmosphere. But gradually, the British troops, as they always do, established themselves as friendly, reasonable, well-behaved individuals. They're the best ambassadors that anybody's ever had. And by the time we left, the East Lancashire, I think it was, yes, East Lancashire, wasn't South Lancashire, East Lancashire it was, who were in Ninecutson, which is one of the mining areas, when they used to play football for the local teams, when they left, they were presented with a piece of silver, which was a great tribute to the equanimity and the impartial and balanced outlook and attitude and way of life of the British soldier, in my opinion. And that, I think, goes on. It was very good. But then the plebiscite came, and they had international observers. And we were, my contingent had to go out and be on duty at the various polling stations. And then we had the job of collecting the voting, the boxes, the urns with the votes, and bringing them back with the international observers to the counting house in Saarbrücken. Wonderful story told about one group of soldiers who were at one polling station, and they had these two international observers who were sort of supervising and making sure that the plebiscite was being conducted properly. And then when it came to bringing the urns back, one of the observers couldn't be missing, and the story is that the large corporal in charge, or the corporal in charge of this small detachment, said, "Where's the so-and-so with the bowler at? We lost the chap with the bowler at. You've got to find the chap with the bowler at before we go back." And I can picture, I was in the counting house in the place in Saarbrücken where the votes were being counted. And I can see the soldiers now. It was very hot inside this. It was cold outside, but very hot inside this place. In their shirt sleeves, bringing in the urns with the paper, voting papers in them, and dumping them in front of the counters, and then going out and going and looking for another one. It really was an extraordinary experience. But the British soldier showed up remarkably well. He did his stuff brilliantly. He didn't lose any voting papers, he didn't lose any urns, and he brought back all the international observers intact, even with their bowler hats.
How about the other nationalities, the Dutch and the Swedish?
The other nationalities, the Italians couldn't understand us at all, because they went about with revolvers and so on, and cloaks with their scarlet linings, and they simply couldn't understand that my brigadier and I used to go out for a walk in the afternoon in Saarbrücken. We were particularly outside Saarbrücken. There's one of the, I can't remember which battle it was, one of the battles of the Franco-German War, 1870. And we used to go out and study that battlefield. We just walked out with a couple of sticks, a couple of canes. We didn't have any weapons or anything like that. But the Italians couldn't understand that. But they reminded me of that remark in, what was it, chap who wrote about, can't remember his name now, a very well-known book about the famous Italian commander who dominated the Mediterranean at one time, who wrote about the Italians. Italians are not fighters in spite of all their bluster and boasting, and that was very true of those people. But they were all right. And the Dutch were a bit dull, but my brigadier had been a great cricketer, and he played cricket for the Free Foresters, taking part in a Free Foresters cricket tour in Holland. So he was very partial to the Dutch, and he used to exchange a bottle of rum for a bottle of balls, which he used to have. And the Swedes were very good. They were much more like us. They were all part-time soldiers. But we got on very well with them. We got on very well with them all. But Jack Don Brind and Jack Swain were very good. But it was a very valuable experience for me in the conduct of sort of what you might call civilian operations on an international basis. And it was very, very valuable from that point of view.
Did it come in valuable later for your experience in the post?
When I was in Italy with Alexander, where I had every blinking race in the world represented. one learned the lesson which I suppose every politician has to learn that command of an international formation is rather like being a leading politician. It's the politics of the art of the possible. And you learned that way. I learned that way. I mean, you learned to be patient and try to understand the other chap's point of view, to be cooperative and not to be aggressive or in any way. No, I think it was a valuable experience, which stood me in good stead in later life.
I think you got a special commendation, did you not, for that?
I think I did. No, it was a useful experience, and it was an interesting one. And in the end, I mean, I think the plebiscite was fairly conducted, thanks to the British troops. And the other international contingents. Yeah, I think it was all right. By the way,